Hi, I'm Sam Seder. This week on Ring of Fire Radio, Justin Elliott from ProPublica will join us to explain the secretive world of work-at-home customer service and how it's exploded during the pandemic. And Heather Digby Parton will help me break down the vice presidential debate, and we'll discuss the insanity that followed after Trump contracted coronavirus. You're listening to the free podcast right now. Do us a favor, support the show. You can become a supporter by heading over to rofpodcast.com. Here to break down this week in news, Heather Digby Parton from Salon and the popular blog Hullabaloo.
Mama, take this badge off of me. I can't use it anymore. It's getting dark, too dark to see. I feel I'm knocking on heaven's door.
Okay, so Heather, every week we say this has been a week that you couldn't top, and but we'll see what happens next week. And then here we are. I think we spoke on Friday afternoon or so, and by Friday evening or at one point, the time escapes me at this point, it was revealed that President Trump, I guess it was a late night Thursday night, maybe, he revealed that he was infected with COVID. And over the course of the week, we have found up to at least 34 people in and around the White House, including some journalists covering the White House, were infected with COVID, all of which, from what we can tell now, emanated out of a super spreader event that the White House held in celebration of Ruth Bader Ginsburg's passing and their essentially coronating Amy Coney Barrett as her successor. And since then, we've had a vice presidential debate. We have had the president get an experimental treatment, which apparently, in addition to, according to him, making him feel like he's 20 years younger, also somehow made him super, super tanned in some of the things. We still don't know as of Thursday evening if the president has taken a test to be shown whether it was negative. We do know that there is an NDA, non-disclosure agreements that the president made doctors at Walter Reed Hospital sign a year ago. So what do you think, Heather? I mean, how much crazier can this get?
I just don't know. I mean, you know, we were talking about this just before the show. Within the last, 2.5 weeks now, we had Ruth Bader Ginsburg die, and the decision made instantly on the part of Mitch McConnell to steal the seat, despite the fact that the election is right around the corner. That whole drama that went with that, and that was the highlight for the Republicans. That was their one moment of real joy in the last, you know, couple of months. And then right after that, you know, we get this story about Trump's taxes, which was huge. I mean, in any other election, that would have been the October surprise, right? I mean, this would have been a gigantic story that would be dogging him on a daily basis. And at this point, you know, now it's forgotten. Then we had that crazy debate, that completely Looney Tunes debate that we talked about last week. And then, you know, just 2 days later, it was the middle of the night. I don't even know if you were awake when that news came down. I was, because I'm on the West Coast. And I'm like, oh, my God, you know, Trump has tested positive for COVID. And then the next day he's being, you know, helicoptered to Walter Reed. I mean, this is unbelievable. And I just, you know, I just can't imagine what happens next. I mean, it is beyond my imagination to go through this. Now, one of the things that we're starting to see, I think, the beginnings of, we just got a story this week about, you know, up in Michigan where they had a militia that was actually, you know, agitating and planning to kidnap the governor of Michigan. Sounds like a pretty serious situation. I mean, I don't know. You know, maybe it's really just a couple of yahoos and the Department of Justice is turning it into a big deal. I mean, we'll find out. But that seems unlikely to me, because this is the last Department of Justice that would be doing something like that, right? I mean, they're not exactly trying to bring the hammer down on right-wing, extremists. So this, I don't know if that's kind of a harbinger of something to come. Perhaps it is. I don't know. But this is just crazy. And the fact that Trump has COVID and he's now decided, he's walking around, as you say, very tan, very agitated. He is extremely, it's hard to say. In fact, I wrote a whole piece this week about how his crazy behavior on Twitter, and since he's gotten COVID, and he did joyride around with his entourage and the poor Secret Service guys in PPE outside the hospital. I mean, he's been doing crazy things, but when you look at it, it's hard to attribute that to steroids, because he's always doing crazy things. So we don't really know what it is that's going on in his head, but it's clear that COVID has changed the game in some way. And we're starting to, we're going to have to keep a very close eye here on what exactly that means. But it seems to have, and certainly in the polling, shows that when he got COVID, he lost large numbers of folks, and for good reason, because they went, wait a minute, this guy has been ignoring all the guidelines, has been ignoring all the medical advice, and look what's happened. So he didn't get any sympathy out of it. So I don't know where that leaves us. I mean, I'm sitting here just waiting every day, for the next shoe to drop.
Right. Well, and adding into that, during this week, the president tweeted out at one point, like, we're calling off negotiations for any type of COVID relief, which I think came out of a conversation he had with Mitch McConnell, who reportedly told the president, look, you're not going to get anything out of that deal. Forget it. Let's just do the Amy Coney Barrett confirmation. That's what we should focus on. Now, that makes total sense to me from Mitch McConnell's perspective, because I think Mitch McConnell is of the mind that Donald Trump is probably going to lose the election. Certainly, we're starting to see some reporting now that donors seem to be trying to focus and salvage the Senate races. And that is probably more prominent in Mitch McConnell's mind. But even beyond that, I think, is Mitch McConnell's desire to cement his legacy by, placing another Supreme Court justice on the court, in addition to the, who knows how many, maybe another 5 or 10 federal judgeships until then. And so, here is the thing that I think, we've been talking about, we're not alone in talking about this, that Donald Trump's sort of maybe plan B, maybe it's a plan A, is to create enough confusion and sense of illegitimacy around the election, and specifically mail-in ballots. We're seeing, the courts trying to help them out in certain situations. Supreme Court ruled this week that in South Carolina, you need witnesses to sign off on ballots. You have other courts that are invalidating ballots. In Iowa, it's gone back and forth. There's been, we know that the Department of Justice got involved in an investigation of 8 or 9 ballots that were found in a garbage can in an office in Pennsylvania. Also, the DOJ this week issued new guidelines on the permissibility of U.S. attorneys basically going public with investigations right up to an election, which in the past has been verboten, although we know James Comey did not necessarily follow that policy. I guess what I'm getting at here is, and Trump has since come back to the table with attempting to negotiate with Nancy Pelosi over the COVID thing, is that what happens to a, we know what Donald Trump was, at least, headed towards in terms of this election, with the support of the Republican Party. What happens when Donald Trump starts getting super desperate, right? Like where you know, he's backed out of, supposedly, we don't know yet, of next week's debate because it's going to be remote as opposed to infectable, is how I would describe an event with Donald Trump at this point, or infectious. I mean, there is, like, you know, I you know, it is a concern. Like, you know, this guy's on, we know he's being treated with an experimental cocktail of drugs. Certainly, people say that on steroids, it can create, you know, mental changes in your disposition. I mean, I worry a little bit. Maybe the guy's going to be feeling very cornered. And who knows what happens after that?
I don't have any doubt, to tell you the truth. I mean, I'm beyond worried. I'm assuming that he is going to feel cornered. I mean, he's signaling, you know, in every direction that he's not going to just, you know, go quietly if this doesn't go his way. And you know, you think about things like this. I mean, you know, the guy does have a tremendous amount of power. He's the president of the United States. He's the commander in chief of the military. There are many things that he could do if he chose to, and he is, you know, unstable on the best of days, and now he's on a drug cocktail that nobody really knows how that will interact with, you know, with these drugs and with him. And, you know, steroids are the last thing you want a sort of malignant, narcissist, kind of sociopathic guy to be on, and he is obviously facing, you know, an incredible, the possibility of a monumental defeat, which for him, I think, is just, that's personality shattering, right? I mean, this is the kind of thing that he just is incapable of sort of absorbing and certainly taking any responsibility for. So I don't know what he is going to do, but I am pretty convinced he's going to do something. Let's just put it that way. Now, the big question is, and I mean, this is, goes back to the question you and I've been pondering the entire, you know, period that Trump has been in the spotlight, is what will the Republicans do? And I think that what, you know, they are the only ones who apparently have any power to do anything, and they have chosen not to use it, and in fact have enabled him and been his accomplices and henchmen in carrying out anything he wanted to do. And there's little evidence that they have any intention of changing that. However, what you mentioned with the McConnell thing that happened with the stimulus, I think, is kind of interesting. Because what it appeared to me, and it was only one story, and I think it was in the New York Times, one of those Maggie Haberman stories, where there was just a line in it in which it's, they said that McConnell and McCarthy had been talking to each other prior to, you know, the talks, you know, Trump pulling out of the talks for the stimulus. And it apparently, McConnell told Trump, now what's important is the way he told him this. What you describe is absolutely right. McConnell's figured out, you know, this doesn't do me any good. This isn't going to help me. He's probably setting himself up for, you know, a Trumpless government where he's going to have to, you know, he wanted to preserve his, you know, his ability to be a deficit hawk or whatever. But what he told Trump was, we can't pass whatever Pelosi and Mnuchin are putting together, we can't pass in the Senate. Well, that's ridiculous, of course, because all he would have needed would be 13 Republicans. If Trump had signed off on that stimulus deal that Mnuchin and Pelosi were putting together, assuming they got to that point, it hadn't gotten to that point, but they were making some progress, apparently, at least we're talking. All you know, if Trump had backed that, of course he could find 13 Republicans to go along with it. If he had said, I need this, there would have been 13 to do it. McConnell didn't want them to do it. And so he basically, you know, and the president is addled at the moment. He's sick, he's on drugs, he's, you know, crazed about the election. So he wasn't paying attention. And so that's when he decided, oh, I've got to take control here. And he issued his, you know, tweet in which he said, I am pulling out of the talks. We'll do this after I win the election, basically, but not before. And so essentially he ended up taking blame for the whole thing for no good reason. And, you know, you have to wonder what McConnell's game is there. So it's the first time I've seen in a very long time a sort of assertion And it was, of course, very craven and opportunistic, and has it, not for the common good in any way, but for Mitch McConnell's good. But to see this kind of machination, and in a way taking advantage of the sick president, actually, which is, you know, fine with me. I don't care. I mean, whatever. But, you know, if only they did it for some good purpose, that would be fine. But it occurred to me that really was a sign that we're starting to see a little bit of
daylight.
Shift.
Yeah.
Yeah, but, you know, a little bit of a schism in this Republican, you know, barrier, this barricade that they've put up around themselves and with Trump. So, you know, I don't know what that means, because there really isn't much left to do. I mean, they all want to get Coney Barrett in, and that's really, I think, McConnell's one, you know, true north is to pack that Supreme Court. But it is kind of interesting, and it'll be interesting to see if Trump keeps acting as crazy as he is right now, where that leads.
Well, I mean, certainly, and we should make this, you know, I think it's implicit in what you're saying, but we should make it explicit that Donald Trump needs to be able to send people money to for the sake of his reelection chances. I mean, there's nobody who doesn't think that it will help Donald Trump to make this deal. I think even the Democrats, are perfectly aware of that, which is why, you know, they're holding the line here. Pelosi has said, you know, we're not doing a standalone airline bailout. Part of the reason why she's holding the line there is because she knows that this is going to help Donald Trump politically. And if that's going to be the sort of the price, him being politically, well, that's going to be the give, then the get needs to be pretty substantial too. One that might, you know, even be durable through the beginning of the Biden term, you know, to some extent. But yes, Donald Trump seemed, at least when he put out that tweet, to be completely operating in his least best interest, right? I mean, you at the very least, you pretend that you're going to negotiate, and then you walk away and blame the other person. In this instance, you're right. He's just basically saying, like, we're not going to have another stimulus, and I want everybody to know it's my fault. And like you say, Mitch McConnell, happy to have that that situation happen. That doesn't bother him. He's, you know, it's, you know, one wonders if the White House comes to an agreement with Pelosi, you know, what does Mitch McConnell do at that point? I mean, I imagine he's got to pass it, but he's going to complain to the president. And it's not, you know, I think we're very close to the window where it becomes, you know, irrelevant. I don't know how quickly they can turn around checks, maybe in 2 weeks, maybe in a week. But I would imagine the president would be like, the first set of checks are going to Michigan and Wisconsin and Pennsylvania and Florida. I mean, that's the way that this White House operates. It is interesting to see that, at the very least, McConnell is in some part hedging his bets in terms of, you know, where things are going to head in the future, and also, you know, sort of like how you know, I guess, you know, what he's willing to do for the sake of the presidency. And this daylight is, I mean, it's good to see as maybe a mile marker. I don't know if it will have any sort of direct impact on the outcome of the election, but it is helpful to see anyways.
Yeah, I mean, well, look, I mean, we should have been seeing it a long time ago. Although, you know, I think that, you know, Trump, McConnell and the rest of the Republicans have been perfectly happy with Trump. I mean, you know, he can be a little embarrassing sometimes, but basically he gets there, you know, he's there to do their bidding. And, you know, until now, when it looks as though, I mean, I think they may have been thinking that he might be able to pull this off. But it's not looking very hopeful at the moment for that he's going to be able to, you know, to pull off this election. So, yeah, now they're hedging their bets. But, you know, they're completely self-serving and have been from the very beginning. And I don't, you know, and I honestly don't believe it really has that much to do with them being cowards. I think it has to do with them. It's like, and I mentioned this, I think, last week, you know, Grover Norquist back in 2012 or something, he was giving a speech to CPAC. And he said, look, we don't really, this he was talking about, he says, look, we've got it, we've got the Congress that we need. They had Paul Ryan at the time in the House. We don't need, you know, the presidency. The president, we just need a you know, someone with working digits that can sign a piece of paper, that can hold a pen, he said. We need someone with working digits that can hold a pen. That is what Donald Trump has been to these people. You know, they couldn't get the ACA, you know, repealed. So then they just went another route. You know, now it's going to be in the Supreme Court, and they're probably going to repeal it that way. But, you know, other than that, there's been nothing that they really wanted that they haven't gotten from Donald Trump. They've packed the courts. They got their tax cuts. They're doing vast, you know, deregulation in ways that I don't even, it's going to take years to unravel all that. And so it's been a successful presidency for them. They, you know, they're fine with Donald Trump. He's provided so much distraction that they've been able to work under the radar to do all kinds of things that we probably don't even know about. I'm sure we don't even know about. So, you know, these Republicans, I mean, they're the real, you know, they're the real monsters in this because they were willing to put the country through this.
Oh, no, I couldn't.
For the last 4 years.
I couldn't agree more. And so let's just shift a little bit to the question of like of the president's COVID. I mean, we don't know if he's tested negative yet. Like we don't, and they won't tell us. I mean, this is, there's one of two things that are going on. He refuses to take a test because he doesn't like it or whatever it is, or he's still coronavirus positive.
Oh, he is. There's no doubt about it. I don't think there's any doubt that he's still got the virus and he's still contagious as hell. I mean, the guy's in the hospital just 3 days ago.
But he feels better than he's ever felt in 20 years.
In 20 years. Well, yeah, you take a bunch of steroids, you're going to feel that way. And then guess what happens when, you know, when you stop taking them? It's a bad crash. I mean,
that's why you don't stop.
I'm convinced that he's not going to collapse here. The course of this disease can be very, you know, very unpredictable.
Yeah.
You know, you can go and feel great, and then especially when you're on this drug cocktail that he's on and on these heavy steroids, he might be feeling just fine, and then one day it's boom, you know, he winds up back. I mean, many, many people have had that. Or he may be one of those lucky ones who, you know, had a moderate, you know, mild version of it and get through it. But there's no doubt that he's contagious. The big question to me, or it has to be treated as if he's contagious, because we don't actually know how long he's had it. Now, this is really what is so stunning. Aside from all the, you know, the happy talk from the doctors and having the Walter Reed doctors sign NDAs and all this crazy stuff, I mean, we've never seen anything like that. We don't know when he got this thing. I mean, he went on Maria Bartiromo this week and said, you know, he kind of implied that he got it from the Gold Star families. Well, that's not true either. It isn't. The way it's looking is that he got it even before that. And if anything, he's been the one spreading it around because he refused to wear a mask. And the thing is, it looks as though, because they're being so cagey, that hasn't been being tested either. If he had been tested, why can't they tell us when the last negative test was before he tested positive? Because that's what you need to know, right?
Yes.
That way you'd know where it started. You'd know, okay, he was okay on this date, and then he got it this date, so somewhere in here is where he got it. They will not reveal that information. And one of the things that I think is obvious that we're going to find out is that he either didn't test and went to that debate and lied about being tested, because remember, they all showed up late for the debate, the Trump and his entourage, and they were on the, quote, honor system because it was too late to test there, like you'd put any Trump in the honor system, but that he lied. Yeah, he lied and said, yeah, I tested negative today, I'm all good, don't worry about it. That's one possibility. It's also possible that he tested positive and didn't care because he felt good, right? Yeah, hey, and this is so would be so typical of him. Yeah, I tested positive, but I feel fine. So, you know, there's no problem here,
right?
Because that's how he thinks about this. We don't know what that is, but I think it is almost, you know, 100% likely that he showed up at that debate and lied and exposed Joe Biden to the coronavirus. Now, so far it looks good that Biden didn't actually get it, thank God, but I think we're going to find that out, and that's one of the most despicable, irresponsible things anyone has ever done in politics. I mean, it's absolutely horrible if that turns out to be true.
I think you're right. It's impossible to discount. I mean, it is completely baffling. I mean, it's not baffling. I mean, you've just laid out the possible explanations, but it is still just, I guess, stunning that they feel perfectly fine saying that he confirmed that he was positive Thursday night. That is a weird sort of phrasing. And and that they cannot address any other test that he's taken, which is very strange. I have no doubt. I mean, I don't know if you do, but I have no doubt that if Donald Trump was COVID negative today or Thursday or Friday or tomorrow or whenever, they would announce it seconds after that test turned, you know, blue or whatever it is that, you know, that they would be out there and, he's the Ubermensch. He's cured. So it is just. It's nuts. It really is nuts. And I made this clear last week on the Majority Report. I will say it here too. I don't have the time to expend any sympathy for him. I mean, there's 200,000 people who've passed away. There's hundreds of thousands of people who have lost people. And there are literally millions who have contracted COVID. When I get through that list of feeling sympathetic for each one of those individuals, I will then contemplate feeling sympathetic for him.
Oh.
But I feel bad for the people around him. I mean, you know, this guy's walking through there, you know, I feel bad for the Secret Service guys. I feel, bad for the Marines and the staff at the White House who have to, I don't know, work in that environment. I mean, it's just, it's nuts. It's nuts.
It's nuts. I feel bad for all those people too. Anybody that works in the support staff in the White House, you know, the people who work in the kitchens and, you know, keep the place running. I don't feel sorry for Hope Hicks, and I don't feel sorry for Chris Christie, and I don't feel sorry for Mike Lee. I don't feel sorry for Kellyanne Conway. I feel sorry for the people that they went out and exposed after acting like these, you know, the reckless kind of arrogant, smug people that it couldn't happen to them. And it did happen to them, and God only knows who they exposed to it when they left that super spreader event for Amy Coney Barrett or any of the other things that they were there doing and exposing themselves and then getting the virus. I mean, I don't feel sorry for them at all. And you know, I think this is why the polls are not showing any sympathy for Trump, because normally you would. I mean, the White House is a hot spot. It's shocking, right? I mean, this is a cluster of COVID in the White House of the United States of America among some very important people have gotten sick. I mean, Chris Christie's still in the hospital, I think. You know, this is serious business, but people are not feeling sympathy in the way that you might expect because they were asking for it, and everybody knows it, that they have been these careless people just walking around pretending like it's politics as usual, that the rules didn't apply to them, they didn't have to do all these things, and in fact, encouraging average Americans to do what they're doing, which was to just pretend like the virus wasn't a threat. And look at the results of that. I mean, how many people have died because of their treatment? In fact, this week, the New England Journal of Medicine did an editorial, flagrantly calling for the Trump administration to be turned out of office because of their COVID response. I mean, and it's shocking because they don't do that. They're not a political organization. And this really isn't about politics and anything other than just this COVID response. They're saying that this is unconscionable what this government did. And, you know, we've talked about this at length for months and months, everything from, you know, getting rid of the testing regime, whatever they had going, because it was only going to help blue states, you know, that kind of despicable, you know, grotesque political calculation when people's lives were at stake. And they called for them to be turned out, because when you look at the comparison between the way the U.S. has handled this and the way everyone else in the world has handled it, and it's a, you know, it's a deadly pandemic and it's extremely contagious, and countries all over the world are still battling it, but nobody has done what we did. I mean,
right.
We have just been absolutely, you know, just horrifically incompetent, and yet we supposedly have the greatest, you know, amount of scientific knowledge and our, you know, the ability
We do have that stuff. The problem is that we have a dysfunctional government and in many respects, you know, a crippled society in many respects. You know, like, I mean, this is a bigger problem than just Donald Trump. He exacerbates it without a doubt. But this is, we have 40% of our population who, you know, they're still very firmly behind Trump. And that to me is a red flag when it comes to, the health of our society. Before we go, Heather, I want to touch on one other story that I don't want to be buried this week. And that is, there was an Inspector General draft report that was leaked from the Department of Justice, which outlines the role of Jeff Sessions and Ron Rosenstein in the Trump administration. They call it family separation. I call it kidnapping policy of immigrant children at the border. And the New York Times has written it up. It is one of the most disturbing things. I mean, to hear Jeff Sessions and Rod Rosenstein basically chastise the U.S. attorneys who are on the border and, you know, telling them, you go ahead and you prosecute these cases so that we can separate these children from these parents and prosecute them just for coming across the border. This isn't the secondary, you know, infraction type of situation. And they would continue to do this even, and the Department of Justice was basically telling them, you continue this even if we're talking about babies, even if we're talking about breastfeeding babies. We want these kids taken from these people with the explicit agenda of making this experience so wretching, so painful, so terrifying for the children and for the parents that, the idea of this fate awaits you if you cross the border. They're hoping to disseminate that message amongst folks who are, in many respects, refugees. It seems to me that if there is any value to a human rights criminal court in the world, that it would look into this and bring some prosecutions against people to do something like this. I mean, it's horrific and unbelievably, it's just hard to imagine so many people going along with this and or not refusing to resign.
That's the part that I just, you know, I cannot wrap my mind around. This idea that, I mean, what would it take? You know, what would it take for people to just get up and quit en masse? You know, and this excuse of, well, I felt like I could do more good by being there. Well, you didn't do more good, because look what happened. And you know, we knew the outlines of this story already, of course. I mean, you know, we remember the recordings that ProPublica did of, you know, the crying children and all of this when that story was leaking out all over the place. But I don't think we knew really the role of the two top guys in the Department of Justice who spearheaded this. One was Jeff Sessions, and we knew that he was for it. He gave some speeches at the time, but he was adamant about it. I mean, this story paints him. He is a monster, And, you know, there was a time when we knew that, but somehow or another, you know, that kind of got lost in all the stuff about the Russia investigation. The same thing, I mean, and then speaking of which, Rod Rosenstein is the other one who was pushing this. I mean, he was basically doing a kind of a Pontius Pilate thing, kind of like, you know, this really isn't my thing, so, you know, I'm not going to say anything here. And, you know, this is monstrous. I mean, this is going to go down in history as one of those moments, like, you know, Japanese internment.
Yeah.
and you know, I mean, the genocide of American Indians and, you know, slavery. And, you know, we have a lot of those things. This one happened right, you know, just in you know, what was it, 2 years ago?
Yep.
This was happening in America. And it's absolutely horrific. And, you know, the idea that we're still finding out, you know, what exactly went on there, and that there are still people in the DHS and in the DOJ. I mean, what in the world would it take for those people to go? I mean, even Chris, you know, Kirstjen Nielsen, you know, she finally left, and everybody said they felt sorry. Trump browbeat her in meetings and whatever, you know, poor Kirstjen. You know, she went before the American public and lied.
Yep.
Outright about this program and said, no, of course we're not doing that. And this proved they knew very well what they were doing. Now, she may have objected, and, you know, she did. So what? She implemented it anyway. I mean, that's the old, you know, I was only following orders excuse.
Exactly. And the report is quite explicit that was, in fact, their excuse. And it's really, really disturbing. Heather, we will reconvene next week. And, you know, who knows? The only thing I can tell you is if the aliens do land and invade us, I hope they're wearing masks. And so that's... I guess that's really the question. Will they be wearing masks when they invade? So, Heather Parton, Digby, always a pleasure.
Thank you for having me, Sam.
Sure, you may have seen the ads on social media or television claiming that you can work from home while having flexibility and making good money. But there's a sinister side to the company behind the empty promise. Here to explain what really happens after you get the job and why it's a direct reflection of the gig economy, Justin Elliott from ProPublica. So, Justin, I started to mention to this to you before we started the interview, but you know, there's the only thing I could relate to my reaction to this piece is that there's some stuff that I've read in my past where I, you know, humor that I've laughed out loud, but it's rare. This is one of those rare pieces that I've read about, what's going on in our economic system, if you will, or our society, where literally in multiple occasions, my mouth just dropped. All of this was so, stunning in some ways. So it is an amazing piece of journalism, and it is, I can't encourage people enough to go and read the entire piece. We're not going to be able to do all of it justice here. But you've written at ProPublica about a company called Arise Virtual Solutions, which I'm almost convinced that no one who is hearing this has ever heard of, and that is by design. Give us a sense of what this company does, or maybe we should just start with this. A list of companies, just off the top of your head, it's not a complete list, of companies that use the services of Arise Virtual Solutions.
Sure, yeah, thanks for having me. So Airbnb, Comcast, Apple, Amazon, TurboTax, Disney, Walgreens, so many of the largest brands in the country.
And so it's more than likely that everybody listening to the sound of my voice has at one time or another interacted with, and I want to say Arise Virtual Solutions employees, but they have no employees, or at least not ones that are necessarily public facing. So they have interacted with people who are, I guess, in quotes, partners, if you will, with Arise Virtual Solutions.
Exactly. So this is a company that provides customer service agents to large corporations like like Disney and Comcast and Airbnb. But the entire business model is based on using only contractors. And in fact, not just a sort of simple contractor relationship, but a sort of several contract hops that is designed to allow the large corporations to slash their labor costs and essentially shift those costs onto the workers themselves, who don't get the benefits of minimum wage or benefits or Social Security, et cetera, et cetera.
Okay, so that is the relationship that these workers have with this company in a nutshell. But let's dig into this. I guess we should start with just the sort of the notion as to why we've never heard of this before. Confidentiality seems to be sort of almost job number one for Arise. Explain that dynamic and why it's so important.
Sure. So the people that are doing this work around the country have to sign contracts that, first of all, have strict NDAs, non-disclosure agreements. But it sort of gets even more dystopian than that. I mean, we talked to agents who told us that, for example, when they were working for Disney, if somebody called, they would have to make believe that they were, first of all, Disney employees, which they're not. Second of all, working at a physical call center rather than in their homes, which is where these agents are working. And, they sometimes take sort of extreme measures. There's actually videos on YouTube that you can play in the background that sound like offices. And many agents just, if customers ask them where they are or who they really work for, in some cases they've just been instructed to lie. Part of the reason for that is Disney and these other companies want customers to think that they're really talking to a Disney employee when they're calling Disney to get answers. I think another reason for it is that the large companies that are using this system would rather the public not know that the people answering phone calls for them are, in some cases being paid a few dollars an hour and are working under, terrible conditions.
And in the piece, there are instances where there are code words used in lieu of the companies. I mean, that's the level of secrecy that is demanded by Arise.
Right. So they're kind of funny. Like Disney gets referred to by the agents as like the mouse client for Mickey Mouse. Airbnb, they would call the bed and breakfast client. The agents, have Facebook groups and other places online where they sort of compare notes. If they identify who they're working for, they can get fired, or in the sort of lingo of the industry, they can have their contract terminated, because technically, again, they're not actually working for any of these companies.
And you outline, well, before we get into this, because I want to talk about you use an example, Tammy Pendergraft, a worker for this company, I guess, or a worker with this company in the way that they would create this parlance. But amidst all this secrecy, how did you guys report this out? Let's start with that just so that we can lay that groundwork and then get into sort of the dynamic here, which is really, really stunning. I mean, this is
sure.
I'm trying to come up with an analogy as to what this is in terms of a job, I guess. But I mean, let me put it this way for folks. Think about the worst aspects and the most exploitive aspects of the gig economy, and then put that under a magnifying glass and give it, growth hormones. And then that's where we're at. How did you get this information?
Sure. So it all started actually last year when I was writing about TurboTax in sort of a whole different story. And as part of that reporting, I started to get calls from people who were working as customer service reps for TurboTax. And one woman who called me said, yeah, it was this weird thing where I worked for, taking phone calls from my home, from TurboTax customers for a couple months. And at the end of it, I actually owed them money. And I was like, okay, that seems weird. I've never heard of, like, why would you owe them money? And so, you know, we started looking into it, and we learned that when people worked through this company, Arise, and a couple other peer companies, part of the whole system as contractors is they actually have to pay fees to Arise in order to have the privilege of working, and essentially, like, they're paying to take your phone call. And so there's a lot of fees that the workers actually pay, and also for their training. So in some cases, they actually literally lose money doing this work. So we started talking to a lot of agents, and then we also were able to get a lot of documents from the National Labor Relations Board that had a case related to this company, and through some public records requests, we got a sort of large cache of documents that documented some cases over the years that sort of revealed the whole business model.
So we should say, I mean, this is there's an element of this that is equivalent to, I guess, like on some level, like we're going to, like, I'm a company that owns taxi medallions and I'm going to rent it out to taxi drivers. The way that taxi drivers, and they're still getting hit hard, particularly in this environment with stuff like Uber and Lyft, but the way that we ensure as a society that the taxi drivers don't get ripped off completely is theoretically the city regulates how many medallions there can be. So there's a limited amount of taxi drivers so that theoretically they'll all be able to get business and make money at it, et cetera, et cetera. But in this instance, there seems to be absolutely no regulation. And part of their business model, it appears to be, is to lure people in with promises of working at home, and then basically just overstaff so that they don't have to actually ensure that people make any money off it. But before we get there, let's talk about the genesis of this company, because that in and of itself is also a little bit disturbing. It was set up originally as a way of, I don't know if exploiting is the right way, but taking advantage of people who maybe had disabilities and couldn't leave their homes.
Yeah, that's right. It actually started in Canada originally in the late 80s, and then later moved to Florida. And it was started by this guy, Richard Cherry, who's a sort of serial entrepreneur. He also has written books about weight loss and sort of how to get rich quick type stuff. And the idea was, he wanted to kind of unlock this hidden workforce of people with disabilities to do this customer service work. But from the very beginning, this company Arise sort of had two revenue streams, right? I mean, first of all, they're getting paid by the Carnival Cruise or Disney that is hiring them. But then they, from the very beginning, they were actually charging fees to the agents who are on what they call their quote unquote platform. And so in many ways, it kind of pioneered the kind of Uber business model or a twist on it before Uber even existed. And then some other companies started doing the same thing. And, you know, fast forward to the present with COVID and the closing of physical call centers, and this whole work at home industry for customer service is booming.
All right. So tell us the story of Tammy Pendergraft, because this story has everything in it in terms of abuse of our labor laws or skirting of our labor laws, and ultimately the demise of our labor laws in some instances, and the demise of an opportunity for workers to get redress in our courts. But let's start with Tammy Pendergraft, whose story you tell to, I think, illustrate the dynamic that takes place, like how people come to work for Arise or work for an entity that works for Arise or something like that. Go ahead.
Sure. So I think it's useful to compare this to how it would normally work if you were, you know, just a normal call center employee. And those obviously are often not great jobs to begin with. But if you can imagine going to work at a call center and being a new employee, right, you would get training, you would get assigned your cubicle and your little headset and your computer. And you would probably sort of sit on some calls with with a more experienced person before you started taking calls, and you'd ultimately start taking calls yourself. And of course, you would be paid for all that. You'd be showing up to work every day, right? So with Tammy Pendergraft, this is a woman who lived in Houston. She hurt her back, and so she couldn't work in an office. So she ended up finding this company, Arise. Their advertising is sort of heavily targets women who have to work at home for one reason or another. And the pitch, as you said, is all about having freedom at home, you know, being an entrepreneur, that kind of thing. So we were able to piece together from legal records that she, first of all, she had to pay for her own equipment. So she paid around $1,500 for a computer, headsets, a phone line. She had to pay Arise for her own background check. And then she had to take this training course for AT&T, which was the ultimate company that, you know, was using her labor here. And that took 44 days, which none of which she was paid for. And so then she spent 3 weeks fielding phone calls from AT&T customers. And at the end of that, she finally receives her paycheck, and it's for $96. So she's basically starting, you know, well over $1,000 in the red, and also having worked for free for, you know, months.
And so what was the initial sales pitch? I mean, like, how does someone like Tammy, and you don't know the specifics because she wouldn't speak to you because, of course, she had to sign a non-disclosure agreement when she got involved with Arise. But so all of this is reconstructed from court documents, right? Or from...
That's right.
And so how did Tammy come to work with, I guess, Arise? What was like on what basis did she think this was a good idea? Because you've just outlined that she worked 40 days plus another 3 weeks. I mean, we're talking, like you say, a couple of months, and she's net out of pocket in actual cash, never mind a time invested, over $1,000. What was the sales pitch? I mean, obviously they didn't say like, come work for us, you know, within 3 months, you'll have only lost $1,000.
Right. So the sales pitch is, there's sort of different versions of it, but one of the common themes is work-life balance and, you know, are you a stay-at-home mom who, can't go to a traditional job outside the home because you're doing, you know, you're doing caregiving work. And you know, you can make some easy cash doing this work. You're going to have freedom. They actually do a lot of advertising on daytime television. There's a great segment on this talk show, The Real, which is kind of like a more millennial-oriented version of The View. It's like four women. And Arise has had paid segments on that show where the host do a whole skit where they're doing this work. And so, you know, you can deduce from that the type of people who the company is targeting. And frankly, some people who worked in the industry told us this candidly, they're targeting people that don't have any other options. Even though they might find out that this is a terrible deal, they're in a situation where they kind of have to take it or leave it. And even though this might be violating federal labor law, if no one's enforcing it, and these companies can, you know, like AT&T and Airbnb and all the others can get away with it, you know, they're going to keep using these people.
I mean, this sounds like, frankly, a modern day version of sharecroppers, you know, following the Civil War, frankly. Where you had people who had, you know, limited skills, they needed to come back and work on the farm, and then they basically just became indentured servants on some level.
Yeah, I mean, I think the striking thing to us was that even though, as you said, like no one has heard of Arise or there's some other companies that basically do the same thing, but really what this is about is, you know, blue chip companies that everyone has heard of, like Disney, Comcast, Home Depot, they are the ultimate beneficiaries of this system. They're using this system to fatten their profit margins and transfer costs onto workers that have traditionally been borne by companies. And again, that's things like training, equipment, and so on. So, you know, I think what's really going on here is that we've historically, you know, set a kind of floor of labor standards in this country, and, you know, the basic things like minimum wage, having to be paid for bathroom breaks, that sort of thing. And this whole business model is an end run around that. And it's affecting, you know, a large and increasing number of people in the country.
And just for the record, so the Arise gets paid by, let's say, Home Depot or whatever entity is using them, and they also they get paid by the worker for using their platform, essentially, to give them the opportunity to work. And so they're getting paid in both directions here. And then there are some entities that you talk about that essentially function as almost subcontractors of the contractors of Arise, right? Because we're talking like three levels of contracting that's going on. So I could start up a business where I'm basically just providing to Arise. I mean, it's sort of like there's a little bit of a pyramid scheme-y type of quality to it.
Right. So there, in some cases, in many cases, there are as many as three contracts between the, you know, the Home Depot and the worker who's answering the customer calls for Home Depot. So it would be Home Depot contracts with Arise, which then contracts with this, what they call a quote unquote independent business. And that's often somebody that then has sort of hired five of their friends or family members in some cases. And those are the people that are actually taking the calls, working as agents, and those agents are paying fees to both Arise and also this extra hop above them, the independent business, for the privilege of working. So, you know, we published some paychecks where you just, you know, in one case, somebody was taking calls for TurboTax. You know, they grossed $278 for working 23 hours, but then after all these fees were subtracted, $278 turned into $58.
So, $58 for 23 hours.
Right, which works out into $250 an hour, which is like below even the already low federal minimum wage. And I want to point out also, I mean, people, it might sound like to people that Arise is this kind of fly-by-night operator, but it's actually owned by Warburg Pincus, which is one of the most elite and sort of prestigious private equity firms in the whole world. I mean, it's the president of Warburg Pincus is Tim Geithner, Obama's former secretary of treasury.
So we have a former Obama secretary of treasury who oversees this company, which owns Arise, a hedge fund that owns Arise. And so this is very, very well entrenched. But what sounds to me like this sounds like all sorts of illegal labor practices. So let's cut to some of the documents you have from National Labor Relations Board cases. Talk about this guy, Matthew Rice, because that's where some of this misclassification came up. And here's where the story also just gets more disturbing and depressing as you go, because all the avenues that we, I think, presume exist in our society to protect people from this type of exploitation seem to be foreclosed. But let's walk through that. The National Labor Relations Board took a look at this through this case with Matthew Rice. Just tell us a little bit about that.
Sure. So basically, some of the workers that have done this labor have actually essentially tried to sue. You know, and the basic legal claim is, look, you classified me as a contractor, but actually everything about this setup looks like normal employment. And therefore, you owe me back wages for all the money I, you know, you paid me less than minimum wage. You owe me for all the money I paid for the training that should be paid legally by the employer, et cetera, et cetera. Arise, and this is quite common, has attempted to protect itself by including these class action waivers in their contracts, which basically say you can't, find other workers like yourself and sue us as a group collectively, which is what, you know, which is what these companies fear. And instead, you can't even use the federal court system. You have to use this sort of parallel system of arbitration that's totally private, and it's all kind of one-offs. It's not going to be thousands of agents going in together against a company. So,
and let me just interrupt you for 1 second here, Justin, because this is sort of the bailiwick here at Ring of Fire. Obviously, we've been talking about these type of issues for literally well over a decade, and it's gotten simply just sadly worse. The reason why they put these clauses in this contract is because I, as a lawyer, there is not enough money, frankly, for me as a lawyer to spend the years that would be associated with a case like this if I'm just recouping one person's back pay. Because I'm going to put in so much more money than would possibly be worth it for this one person. And so they attack the concept of class action so that I can't represent 100 or 200 or 300 or 500 thousands of these workers in one case to rectify it. And then, of course, they don't want us to go into courts. They want us to go to arbitration because we know these arbitration companies, they don't get paid by the person who's coming, by the employee or the non-employee. They get paid by the corporations. And so we know where these arbitration places know where their bread is buttered, as it were. And so that's why that these things are structured in this manner. But I just wanted to lay that out there. So continue.
Yeah, right. Absolutely. And the remarkable thing in this case is that we were able to get these arbitration records, which are normally confidential. And even though, as you say, the whole arbitration system is sort of tilted towards business, Arise actually lost in at least a couple cases that we found. And these administrative law judges found that this whole setup was violating federal labor law, and that these people, these customer service reps, should have been employees who were getting minimum wage and not having to pay for their training and so on. But as you said, these are just one-offs, so that becomes a kind of cost of doing business. There was a Supreme Court ruling in 2018, the Epic Systems ruling. It was a 5-4 case in which this issue of class action waivers in contracts, in employment contracts, came up, and the court ruled 5-4 in favor of allowing these things. And so what has happened, even though Arise has lost in several arbitrations, is that they've been able to continue essentially without changing their business model. They've continued to grow. The main thing that has changed is they no longer will hire agents in a handful of states, including California and like New York, places that have tighter state-level labor laws. But basically the business model has been, surprisingly resilient, in part thanks to, limiting the options of agents who want to, have their day in court.
Now, I want to really emphasize this last part because, elections have consequences. The Supreme Court has consequences. This is obviously hugely important, particularly right now. But when Neil Gorsuch got put on that court, taking Merrick Garland's seat, that changed the nature of the ability for workers like this to get redress because of that Epic Systems versus Lewis case. The progress that had been made in terms of bringing a broader case which would really impact the way that Arise does business was completely and utterly shut down at that moment by the Supreme Court, basically saying you can have in your contract taking away the right of people to band together so that they could get redress. We've seen this in the Supreme Court. They did this with the Concepcion case in AT&T. You sign that contract with AT&T. They rip you off for $3 a month for years. You're not going to go to court against AT&T. You're going to try and band together with other consumers who have suffered the same fate. But of course, that is now out of the picture, too, because of the Supreme Court. So let me ask you this. If these states, these handful of states, Massachusetts, New York, California, a couple others, you said, where they actually offer these protections for workers, if they were able to fashion statutes to make what Arise is doing that much more precarious there, is there anything that can happen on a federal level? Do we need a different National Labor Relations Board? How can this be, this be addressed go ahead.
There's a couple things. I mean, so first of all, the Federal Department of Labor does, in theory, enforce what they call the classification rules, which is, again, are there companies that are classifying workers as contractors when really they're employees and therefore, should enjoy all these benefits. So the Federal Labor Department has not been, as you can imagine, pursuing sort of robust enforcement of on this front during the Trump era, but there would be nothing stopping them from going after these types of setups if there was a different administration, first of all. Second of all, you actually have seen movement in several states across the country that have set up what are sometimes called these misclassification task forces, because we've seen most prominently with Uber and Lyft, but also with this customer service world, you see it in construction. I mean, this whole trend of companies wanting to use contractors instead of employees while maintaining sort of employer-like control over their work. This is just spreading throughout the whole economy. And so there are states that are attempting to crack down on it. So state AGs, state labor departments, they all could be enforcing laws that are on the books in many states. And then finally, there are, even though the sort of traditional class action, the binding together of plaintiffs has been sort of largely shut down, there are now a couple of private law firms that are calling these companies bluffs and just filing thousands and thousands of individual arbitrations. There's an interesting saga going on with that against the company DoorDash on a kind of similar basis. And so these companies that had these binding arbitration clauses were never really expecting people to actually use it for the reasons you cited. And now in some cases, the bluff is being called.
Interesting. Well, Justin, this is an amazing piece of reporting. I can't encourage people enough to look this up and read this whole piece, because there's about, a half a dozen of major structural problems in our society that are covered in this story that really give you a sense of, how workers are disempowered in what, amounts to a thousand sort of paper cuts. This piece really covers it. The meet the customer service reps for Disney and Airbnb who have to pay to talk to you. Justin Elliott from ProPublica, thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Thanks a lot.
Justin Elliott has been a reporter with ProPublica since 2012, where he has covered money and influence in the Obama and Trump administrations, the American Red Cross, and TurboTax maker Intuit. And that's it for another week of Ring of Fire Radio. Thank you to all of our free podcast subscribers who decided to become supporters of this program this week. If you're listening to the free podcast, become a member of the full show over at rofpodcast.com. Don't forget, you can follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can watch our videos on YouTube. You can go to ringoffireradio.com to find out more. And check out my daily show, The Majority Report. Head over to majority.fm for my daily live stream covering all the biggest news stories of the day. I'm Sam Cedar. This has been Ring of Fire.